Okay.
Do you do the language warning?
Yeah. So language warning, take one. Hey, everyone. Warning, 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 SOS.
No, that's annoying.
Sorry. Okay. Hey, everyone. On this episode of Unorthodox, we are likely to engage in ethnic chauvinism, inside baseball, and Lashon Hara. We may also use bad language. If any of those things doesn't appeal to you, we invite you to join another podcast community. Hello, Jews and others bundling up for December. This is Unorthodox, the weekly podcast from Tablet Magazine. I'm Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by Tablet Senior writer.
Senior.
Leah Leibowitz.
I work on my puns. You do have a look right now. Like, you look like you have a top knot, like a ponytail at the back.
Right.
Your hair is
your front back. Hair is swept back in a way. You expect a top knot.
Yeah, you should definitely.
Yes, yes, yes.
Can you turn around? Can we see?
I am a senior writer.
And Tablet deputy editor Stefan Butnick.
What up?
And
it's actually Stefani. So it's my alter ego.
And our Jew of the week is Naftali. I wish I knew how to say this guy's last name. He's going to tell me.
Our Jew of the week carries a big knife.
Yeah.
So I would not get his name
speak
wrong.
Speak softly.
Our Jew of the week is Naftali, H-A-N-A-U, who is a certified shochet.
Let's play now.
I like hey now.
Hey now. All right. Who is a shochet, a certified kosher slaughterer, trying to bring ethics and fair treatment of animals into the world of kosher meat. He runs a Brooklyn firm called Grow and Behold, and he is secretly also related to me. And we'll get to that.
Does he know that?
I don't know if he remembers that. I'm actually
going to be great. This is actually the gotcha portion.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a surprise.
And get this. Our Gentile of the week is Snap Judgment host Glenn Washington. So, what's up, Jews?
I just got a text from my sister that said there's like increased police presence outside of all these synagogues she's walking by, like on the way to work. And I think that's really creepy.
Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, I know. Where does she live?
She lives in the Upper East Side.
What would
so
happen?
She was probably walking her dog. And like, I feel like you hit a lot of synagogues.
Well,
there.
Is it also, I mean, she's in the vicinity of the Kushner Synagogue of, you know, KJ.
You think so, that's what it is? Isn't that on the west side?
No.
Oh, no, KJ. No, that's BJ.
No, well, BJ's on the west side. KJ's on the east side.
It's hard to keep those tracks. So, yeah, there's that. You know, the world still. End times.
I was at Minion last night. I go to Monday Night Minion is something I do.
And that's like the most Mark Oppenheimer thing in the world. Like,
it's actually you
whole
and your daughters.
Shabbat thing doesn't really work well, but Monday is convenient.
I go Shabbat
for us.
Too.
We put on our beautiful sweaters.
We will post a picture of today's sweater. It's a controversial sweater, even in my own household.
It's very sweater. You're also wearing a plaid shirt under it.
Yeah, but I knew what I was doing, so I'm in on the joke.
If like you look like you embody Thanksgiving right now.
I don't know if he embodies Thanksgiving. I think he embodies what everyone who voted for Trump think every single one of us look like.
That's right.
You're not doing
the spectacle Jew with good hair and funky sweaters.
I'm that guy. At least they give us good hair. So I was at Minion last night and somebody came in and on their cell phone said there's a fire at the JCC, at the Jewish Community Center, which is 2-3 miles away. And it turns out there was, and it was some electrical fire and everyone's fine and there was no real fire
just brothers.
Smoke. But of course, my first thought was, are they setting our JCCs on fire? Like, it was actually a little bit freaky. Also in our house, you should know that we bought a 6-foot-tall bear.
Is that what you call me now?
So it's almost as big as Liel. So Ellie was visiting so Ellie's our 8-year-old and she was visiting my parents last weekend and they took her to TJ Maxx and my mom said
that's actually what you do with grandparents.
Yeah,
what you do with
grandparents. We call it
TJ's. That is what they do with my mother.
Yeah,
she's
so
the TJ Maxx mother. Yeah.
Yeah, it's my grandma.
Not.
Well, it used to be Lowman's.
KJ
RIP.
On the east
it used
side.
To be, and was
BJ
it?
On the west side. TJ with a grandparents.
TJ downtown.
Yeah.
So it's funny because when they visit Gaga, who's Lower East Side grandma, they bake cookies and go skating in Bryant Park and whatever. When they visit my mother, it's TJ's. So she took Ellie to TJ's and she owed Ellie a few like gifts. Like she for some reason she forgot last year's birthday gift or the gift didn't work out or it broke or something. But then there's this year and then there's Hanukkah plus the birthday that just happened. So she basically said, you get a big present. And Ellie walked into TJ's and she looked over at
big, huh?
The Home Goods part of it. You know the Home Goods part? Because it's TJ/HomeGoods.
Home Goods is the best.
And she saw this bear that when I say it's 6 feet tall, I'm not kidding you. And she ran and jumped in its lap and curled up and said, this is all I want.
Every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today.
So my mom called me and Sid, like we each had these 5 messages on our cell phone at 1 p.m. And my mother's calling saying, can I buy you a 6-foot-tall bear? And we both sort of agreed, well, look, if it's what Ellie wants.
The teddy bears have their picnic.
This bear was $70. now.
So it wasn't like on the clearance rack. Well, it was like
yes,
waiting to go.
I think it was. I think it was $70 down from $500. This bear now, is enormous and plushy.
What is the bear's name?
And the bear, after there was a caucus of all the daughters, and they agreed to name the bear Stariana Honey Oppenheimer.
Stariana is a beautiful name that only a child, like only a young girl could think of.
Yeah, because it's in their mind, it's like what the next figure skating gold medal winner will be named.
Or like Disney princess.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, Stariana.
Stariana.
Yes, Stariana.
Yeah, she's already a Russian figure.
So now she's putting out a publication called the Barrington News, and she's very influential in media.
Oh, this is Ariana. You're doing Ariana.
Isn't this obvious?
It took me a second.
This is my absolute spot-on impersonation of Ariana Huffington.
That's his Greek accent.
So we'll put a picture of Stariana in the newsletter.
Okay, where does Stariana live in your house?
So this is a question, right? Initially, we said, okay, Stariana will have to be sequestered in the basement. But then Stariana took up residence in a rocking chair in our living room, which she fits in perfectly. And you can then go sit in her lap.
That's nice.
But then last night when I went to kiss Ellie goodnight, I discovered Stariana was lying on her floor. So Stariana now lies in front of the bunk beds, and she takes up the entire length of the bunk beds. In the middle of the night, Ellie got up, and I brought her back to bed, and she lay down half asleep and hugged Stariana, like just full body lay on her, on Stariana, hugged her, and then rolled herself into bed.
That's perfect. Oh, because the bear is that big.
Telling you, I've seen this movie, and the next scene is you waking up in the middle of the night, and Stariana's there with a kitchen knife.
That's what we're afraid of.
No, it's Stariana's there with like a joint. We're talking about Ted 2, right?
Do you guys have anything that exciting in your lives?
No.
No. All right. Well,
my father's here for a visit.
What?
It's sort
Big
of the
Ron?
Equivalent of a Stariana.
Of a large,
yeah,
bearish
he just
thing
sits there,
in your
drinks. Yeah.
And what does he do with the kids? What are his grandpa moves? This is bank
his
robber
grandpa,
Rami.
His grandpa moves are pretty much, you know, the kids' moves. There's great synergy there.
Video games.
Like, why don't we jump on the bed and shout for 4 hours? And they're like, that's a fine idea. Let's just do that.
That's strong grandparenting, though.
That's
do
nice.
You want to eat chocolate and get candy? Because that's what I do. And they're like, yeah, that's what we do, too.
That's amazing.
It's great.
It's perfect.
In another 2 or 3 years, you could be sending them to Israel for weeks.
No,
or
in
time.
Another 2 or 3 years, they would have outgrown
grandpa.
Right now, the 3-year-old and 5-year-old are perfectly aligned.
I'd like to welcome some new subscribers to our newsletter, and because these names, I love the diversity and beauty and gorgeousness of the mosaic of our newsletter subscribers. Nate Shapiro.
You know what we should do? I'm sorry.
The mosaic of our mosaic subscribers.
Of our mosaic subscribers, we should play the theme to Schindler's List as our new subscribers join us. And instead of goodbye, Jews, we should say, hello, Jews.
Oh my
welcome,
God.
Jews.
All right. Welcome aboard Nate Shapiro, Marcus Aaron. I love this sort of the melody of these names. Nate Shapiro, Marcus Aaron, Beth Rabin, Julia Klavichik, Myra Feiger, Jenny Gates Beckman, Joel Pliskin, Glenn Levy, and in Israel, Ellie Mike.
The best law firm ever.
Ever. Shapiro, Aaron, Rabin, Klavichik, Feiger, Beckman, Pliskin, Levy, and Ellie Mike. For all of your divorce needs. Also, I just want to give a shout out to Heather Chris and her husband who are listening to us in Jew-free Eastern Washington State. They are keeping the flame alive. And also to my favorite letter writer of the week, Nathaniel Oppenheimer, whom I'm not related to. But if there are other Oppenheimers out there listening, or Butniks or Leibowitzes, just say hi. Just say hi. To get the newsletter, which is now being written by Liel Leibowitz.
There was a coup.
There's
now,
a coup.
Now with 300% more gun references in your unorthodox newsletter.
With an NRA membership button at the bottom, send an email asking for the newsletter to unorthodox@tabletmag.com. Little news of the Jews. Last week, as you know, we tried our best to talk about the first family elect that shall not be named. But the first family elect cannot stay out of the news of the Jews. Kugelgate. This from the
bum, bum, bum.
Bum, bum.
Na, na, na.
I quote from the Daily Forward, a recipe for broccoli kugel that Ivanka Trump claimed was her own family favorite is actually a word for word copy of a recipe by a well-known Jewish cookbook author.
Well, initially it was Michelle Obama's kugel recipe.
The recipe that the future first daughter presented as her own, posted in May on her website, IvankaTrump.com, is virtually identical to a recipe in a 2011 post by Jamie Geller on her website, Joy of Kosher. Both recipes call for 2 pounds of broccoli, 4 eggs, and a cup of light mayonnaise, but the similarities go well past the ingredients. Trump's instructions are worded exactly as Geller's, with only a few words changed. When asked about the matching recipes, a spokeswoman for Geller's company, Kosher Network International, said that the company is flattered that Trump had featured Geller's broccoli recipe.
Look, this this is a Kugel recipe. Obviously, we all know Kugel. There's no less Jewish sentence than both recipes call for 2 pounds of broccoli, 4 eggs, and a cup of light mayonnaise.
Yeah, like, is that even...
Like, what? What?
Is it still Kugel when those are your
ingredients? What kind of maniac puts broccoli
well,
in
that's
Kugel?
The best thing on
that
Twitter.
Absolutely
on Twitter, people are
bizarre.
Like, this isn't Kugel, it's broccoli. Like, that's their issue.
Right, it's like a broccoli mayonnaise salad, basically.
It's my issue, too.
Okay, the best thing is that this article is like the follow-up to a different article that basically was like, Ivanka Trump has a Kugel recipe.
Right.
And someone was like, you know, Jimmy Geller is like a big deal.
She's a big deal, right.
You don't, you know, if you're going to rip something off.
The Trumps are not, they're not subtle about their rip. They, like, they want to be caught.
That's
they have a need,
the
they have a death
thing.
Drive. They
the
have a
con death... is absolute. It's not just like, look, we're going to con you a little bit and then we're just going to do our thing. It's like, we're going to con you on every imaginable level. You think the Kugel is safe? No, 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 no. The Kugel is a fraud. Everything is a fraud. I wonder if, like, people coming for Shabbat at Ivanka's table are treated the same way that Trump voters are now treated. It's like, look, I know I promised you Kugel.
It
was just words. Here's some broccoli.
A dark
broccoli and mayo.
In news from across the pond, Israel won't let ex-New York Nick, now Israeli b-ball player Amari Stoudemire's son play basketball because he's really good at basketball. And also they claim it's because he's not Israeli. 12-year-old Deuce Stoudemire.
Oh, my God.
Did you guys know his son was named Deuce?
What else?
That's
would
amazing.
Amari's son be named?
George Foreman. That was good. Hello, could I get some?
That was a little racist.
Okay.
A little racist. 12-year-old. But also kind of funny.
Deuce Stoudemire has been banned from Israeli youth basketball because they say he's not Israeli. So Peter Kurtz, the president of the Israeli Baseball Association, has thrown open the doors, has rolled out the red carpet, saying, quote, just as the great Michael Jordan made a switch from basketball to baseball, so do we believe that your son can too, and even more successfully.
Wait, even more successfully than Michael Jordan
than Michael
playing
Jordan.
Baseball? Okay,
right.
I just want to see, make sure that the bar is set, like, very high.
Look, as a former second baseman for the Herzliya Hawks, let me tell you, it's a competitive league.
Okay. Are the Herzliya Hawks the ones that wear like the trackers for Mossad?
Finally, porn legend Jenna Jameson, who I didn't realize was converting to Judaism. Have we talked
about
that? We haven't talked about that.
Very publicly, yeah. Like via Instagram, I think she's converting.
That's how one does it. In a tweet this week, porn legend Jenna Jameson, who recently said she has completed a conversion to Orthodox Judaism, wrote that she has a, quote, massive crush on Benjamin Netanyahu. She later commented that Bibi's wife, Sarah, was a, quote, lucky woman to be married to a, quote, complete badass. But it gets weirder. Former KKK super archon deluxe supremo wizard and perennial political candidate David Duke, he tweeted with all those brackets with the echoes around her name, Jenna Jameson reveals massive crush on Netanyahu and Jews dominate porn. Why are Christians okay with that? That is the weirdest tweet ever. He's accusing us of dominating porn, which is debatable. In fact, seems to me, I don't know much about porn, I'll say. And I'd cop to it if I did, but I don't. But I don't think we dominate it. But if we did, wouldn't David Duke want that? Like, does he want Christians to be better than Jews at porn?
I think he wants Christians to, like, decry porn, and Jews are, like, the sinister force behind this, like, awful thing. The scourge.
The Christians aren't speaking out against our porniness,
yes,
enough.
And that we are trying to, like, we're poisoning the country, I think. But by the way, I have to say, I'm pretty sure your conversion is complete when David Duke puts the brackets around your name,
yes,
on Twitter. Like,
yeah,
that, you go, you know, you do the mikvah.
Welcome to the club.
Thing. Yeah.
Welcome to the club.
David
it's a
Duke
last step.
Let's have a moment of real honesty here. Have you seen a Jenna Jameson movie, Liel?
Oh, sure.
Like many?
No.
But one movie many times? Like,
no,
what's your porn consumption level?
You know how open I am about my vices? This
I know
has
you are.
Really never been one of them. There is something so, and God help me, it kind of revolts me. You know, it murders the imagination. It's an affront against the only thing that really should remain sacred about human life. No, it's just disgusting.
Okay,
not because it's like, oh, disgusting. It's just like, really?
Yeah.
Just use your brain. Like, you have
such
a gift.
Do you think inserting Bibi Netanyahu into that would help?
It makes it a lot hotter. Because then you can imagine, like, Naftali Bennett in there and, like, Avigdor Lieberman. And there's, like...
What about Yair Lapid? He'd be great. I want to say, I think this is the first time anyone has called Sarah Netanyahu a lucky woman.
Listen, we have upcoming live shows. Well, we have one we can tell you about, February 10th at Temple Israel in West Palm Beach, and we're working on some super top secret cool other ones to be announced soon.
It's going
to
be huge. Very, very big.
If you want to book us for a live show, contact our producer suprema, Alyssa Goldstein, at egoldstein@tabletmag.com.
We're going to embark on the Lying Press Tour.
That's right. The Lugan Press. While you're on your computer emailing us to schedule a live show, also subscribe to us on iTunes and review us on iTunes, and then send us an email saying you reviewed us on iTunes, and you'll get a cool free gift. And we're already getting emails back from people who've gotten the cool free gift saying, wow, that was a cool free gift. And then hang with us on Facebook. I always eavesdrop on the Tablet Facebook page when we post the episode and read your comments and whatnot. So join me there. All right, everybody. Special Jew of the Week, Naftali Hanau. He's the founder and CEO of Grow and Behold Foods, the Brooklyn-based purveyor of fine kosher pastured meats raised on family farms with no hormones or antibiotics. He's a shochet and a menaker. What's a menaker besides a last name?
Menaker, actually.
What's a menaker?
Menaker is the guy who removes the forbidden veins and fats from the red meat.
Naftali's frequently sought out to consult on kosher slaughter. He's been a judge for Masbia's Chop Hunger and Jamie Geller's Kosher Masters 2016. We were just talking about Jamie Geller since Ivanka Trump stole her Kugel.
Oh, the Kugel Gate was the best.
Kugel
oh
Gate.
My God.
Yeah.
Did any member of the Trump family steal any recipe or slaughtering method from you?
No comment.
Oh, they did.
I would take that as a yes.
That's a yes.
No comment.
If you were invited to the Trump White House to talk about ethical shechita, would you go?
Wow, you guys get right to the tough questions.
He hasn't even asked you how much money you make yet, which is like coming good
up.
For him.
Yeah.
You know, I generally go where I'm invited, so I would have to think about it. I'd have to think about it.
It's
pretty
a tough
hard.
Call, isn't it?
It's a tough call.
Like if they asked you to be the like you know the
ooh the White House
yeah
shochet.
The White House shochet or mashkiach or something and you know
how amazing
if they had one
because we're basically moving back to like Tsarist Russia. Yeah, so they may as well have a shochet in
yeah,
the White House.
Yeah, why would you be their court Jew?
No, they already have a court.
They have a court.
Come on. You know, that I have to say it would be a hard one to turn down because, you know, that's a market right there. You know, they've got, you know, kosher in-laws. It's a lot of kosher meat. That Hanukkah party.
It's a lot of state dinners.
It's a lot of visibility.
That's right.
So how does a nice young man end up as a shochet?
That is what my grandmother said. She was mortified when I told her I was learning kosher slaughter. But I was working on farms. I had gone to horticulture school. That was kind of I jumped off from having a landscaping business in high school. And then I went to horticulture school at the New York Botanic Garden in the Bronx.
You were a crunchy hippie Jew from the start.
Like not deep, from the start. No. I grew up like modern Orthodox in Rochester, New York, just like a normal non-New York area, what people in New York call out of town. But like normal modern Orthodox. I went to day school. I went to yeshiva in New York for a year at MTA, which is why I use high school, and quickly discovered that I'm not a yeshiva boy. It didn't really work for me to be in kind of such a rigid environment where you know, I was taught to be an independent thinker, and that was not so easy in yeshiva. So I went home to public school. I did have the crunchy stage for sure. I worked at Adama, which is a Jewish organic farming fellowship. And when I started there, I was really more on the landscaping horticulture track.
And then one day you saw a chicken. You're like, huh.
No, it didn't start with chicken. I've been a carnivore since I got off the bus early to go into the butcher shop and order stuff on my mom's account. Like the butcher shop was around the corner from my house. So I would just get off there, go in. They would feed me cold cuts. My mom loves to talk about how I ordered lamb chops once. Like I got two lamb chops. I went home. I grilled them. I ate them. And she marched into the butcher and she said, if you ever give him lamb chops, and you do not send lamb chops for me, I'm not paying the bills anymore. So that did not happen.
Kids go to the candy store.
Yeah,
the meat
I went
store.
To the meat store. I've always
you're a meat guy.
I've always been a meat guy.
We have a lot in common.
Yeah, but when I was working at Adama, I realized that actually it's the calling is feeding people. It's not, you know, it wasn't vegetables or meat per se. It was as in just feeding people good food because I've always loved to eat. My mom was always a great cook and we always had people over for meals and Shabbat dinners and barbecues. Actually, the day after Anna and I got married, we were looking at a farm on the Erie Canal. We still thought we were going to be, you know, organic vegetable farmers. But how many organic farmers have you met in America who walk to shul and send their kids to day school and buy kosher food?
We have not met those.
So one now.
The lifestyle doesn't really make
sense.
Well,
no, because I live in Brooklyn and I have chickens in my backyard, but I walk to shul. I send my kids to school. But it doesn't work here because there's no farmland where there's viable Jewish communities. There were, you know, like you go back.
Wait, so that must be the dream. Let's not lie. You're trying to spread
that. The last 200 years really were a bummer for you.
Yeah,
huh?
We've moved in the wrong direction.
You'd be great in Poland circa 1810.
I have to say, it's so funny because I am so glad I don't live in Poland, 1810. I got it. I'm just going to say that right now. And you
may be again, actually. Yeah. We may be moving back there. But
So we live in Brooklyn. We live in this quirky Jewish community. We go to a shul that was established in 1927. And this is really working for us because we get the benefits of being in a, diverse, with quotes, Jewish community, though as diverse as Orthodox shuls get. My wife did not grow up Orthodox, so being in the part of Crown Heights that we are is great because we've got kosher food, but we've also got the Park Slope community, which has all kinds of progressive, things going on. We can send our kids to Lurie Academy, which is an Orthodox school, but a post-denominational community. So it's really kind of a perfect place for us. And we don't have to, be out on a farm, which can be lonely,
So let's talk kosher meat.
Yeah.
There's a stigma, right? There's a stereotype. It's horrible. It's salty, tasteless, lumpy, overly priced. How did things get this bad?
So there's two reasons. One is that it's not just kosher meat. Like, let's just look at mainstream meat in America. If you don't keep kosher, but you just go to the supermarket and you buy some meat out of the meat case, that's probably also not going to taste very good. That's just large-scale commercial meat production. I am not, I grew up kosher, keeping kosher. I've never, knowingly eaten non-kosher meat. But I think that in a lot of ways, the trends you see in kosher meat mirror the trends you see in non-kosher meat. They just follow on a lag. So, mass-produced meat does not taste very good. When you cram animals into really small spaces, you just feed them lots and lots of low-quality food and pump them with antibiotics so they grow faster, you get tasteless meat. It's chewy, it's bland, doesn't have flavor. When you raise animals well, you taste that in the meat. Now, kosher meat, in some ways, there's a bunch of barriers in the system that create the kinds of hurdles that might skew it more towards like low quality. All the labor involved. You need a trained shochet, a trained slaughterman to slaughter the animals. You need trained mashgichim, supervisors, to watch every step of the process. And then you have to pay an agency for supervision. The work that we talk about, menacher, the guy who takes the veins out, that's a skilled butchering position. You can't just go to, they call it a meat locker plant, like a small slaughterhouse, out in the country where, the farmers can bring one or two animals. You can't bring a steer there or a cow there and kosher slaughter it and kosher process it. You'd have to drag a shochet out there. The animal might not even be kosher if it has lung problems. And the guys who work at the meat locker plant are in no way capable of doing the deveining.
Animals with lung problems are not kosher?
Animals with...
So like an asthmatic cow is not fit to eat?
Well, it depends on the inhaler.
Oh, wow.
And what interventions we took.
We learn a lot.
So how is Grow and Behold sort of changing this and addressing this?
So we raise our animals outdoors. We raise them on pasture. They don't get preventative antibiotics. If an animal... And this is, I am not a fundamentalist. I am a pragmatist. I believe Judaism is a pragmatic religion, and I don't think fundamentalism has been good for Judaism. I mean, anybody historically. So let's talk about antibiotics. Never, ever given antibiotics. That's what a lot of consumers think they want. They want to eat animals that have never, ever given antibiotics. But if a cow is sick and it has an infection, the farmer in a never, ever system has two choices. Let the animal suffer. Or treat it and lose it, basically, because once the animal is administered treatment, it can no longer be sold with the never ever, and therefore it's a financial loss. So if an animal is sick, we will medicate it. There are withdrawal periods. We don't slaughter animals that are being actively medicated. You have to wait 30, 60, 90 days. It depends on what the medication is, but we don't want the animals to suffer. And that's, that's one of those places where we're pragmatists, not fundamentalists. But, what we're doing is we are trying to synthesize the main values of high quality food, environmental sustainability, and I guess you can call it social sustainability or, things like the workers, the treatment, all of that stuff. That's what we're trying to integrate to produce the best kosher meat available. It's nice because when you produce animals well, they actually taste better. So when you raise them on pasture, when they get a proper feed, when they get to eat the grass like they're meant to, you taste that in the meat. When the animals aren't stressed in the slaughterhouse, their meat tastes better because they don't have as much adrenaline in that, you know, that actually gets into the meat. So that's really, that's what we're doing.
Now, I want to, you know, I agree with you about fundamentalism. So I call myself a vegetarian. I probably eat meat 10 to 20 times a year in a situation where there's nothing else
He's
to eat.
He's like white right now.
Yeah, like, you know.
Blood is drained from his face after
I should have brought you some jerky.
But, ooh, jerky. You know, and I think, I mean, my wife feels this, my wife feels this even more strongly, which is, look, you know, all this sort of ethical stuff and the sort of foodie attitude towards good meat, kind meat, safe meat, whatever, we're still treating animals as ends, not, or as means, not ends.
That's
we're still.
You hear that, animals?
And, you know, there was a time, I feel like 20 or 30 years ago, the position of people who are concerned about the ethics of the land and the ethics of other creatures was vegetarian. And then in a sense, a certain kind of foodieism or ethical slaughtering, whatever, anti-factory farm stuff came along to say, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. You can read your Michael Pollan and as long as you kill it yourself and look it in the eye, it's, you know.
Name
but at
it.
The end of the day, like, isn't this a step towards realizing that, like, we can eat, it's more gently on the land and more kindly and more virtuously and without being preachy about it, but in our own lives, say, let's eat plants.
There's a lot to unpack there. So there's two pieces I want to pull out of that. One is this Michael Pollan, you have to slaughter the animal yourself and look it in the eye. I am really not a believer in that.
Thank you.
You know, people hire me to do an educational poultry slaughter. Like, I will come to your Jewish day school. You have to provide the chickens, but it's very easy to find. You go on Craigslist, you can get them. For your six, seven,
Craigslist eight, has a live poultry section.
It has everything.
They have everything.
You can have sex with a live poultry in a different part of Craigslist.
Yes, but that we don't want to do with the day school.
Right.
But, you know, and I'll slaughter three chickens for your sixth, seventh, or eighth graders. We could even do fifth graders. And then the kids will get to see, you know, live chickens turn into kosher meat, the plucking, the evisceration, the salting, the soaking, all
that
stuff.
The kids love it.
They probably do.
It's,
oh, I'm sure.
It's fascinating. Yeah. And especially when you do it with kids who are young enough that they're not, like, grossed out before you start, it's fascinating for them. But it's been a very, very long time in Judaism since we have had a system where everybody is supposed to slaughter their own animals. Like, we have to go back to even in temple era times when people were bringing sacrifices, you were not necessarily doing the slaughter. You might purchase the paschal lamb, you'll bring it, you'll participate in the big roasting festival. But, you know, we have a system where only highly trained, vetted people who are accountable to the community are allowed to slaughter our meat. Because the fact is, killing animals is serious business.
Do you have, like, you know how athletes have their, like, kind of like pregame rituals? Do you have your pre-slaughter ritual? Do you have, like, superstitions?
Yeah.
What's on your playlist? Do you have a playlist?
No, there's no.
Do you do warm-ups?
A knife sharpening playlist?
There's no playlist. You check your knives. There's a slaughterman's prayer that you say that basically says, you know, please God, don't let me screw up. Let me do this right. You don't want to waste. You don't want to cause pain. And an animal that's not kosher is a financial loss for somebody, whether right. It's the farmer or the buyer or anybody. But the other thing I want to come back to is also this notion about, you know, just should we eat meat in general, sustainability in general? You know, we're in an interesting place. The meat that I produce is relatively expensive. It is more expensive than the kosher meat you could buy at the big kosher supermarket in Brooklyn or on the Upper West Side. It is as expensive, maybe even a little bit more expensive than what you're going to find in the high-end kosher butcher shop on the Upper East Side. It tastes a lot better than any of the meat, no matter where you're buying it. But the other thing to remember is there are people for whom they're going to eat as much meat as they want to eat. They can afford to, and they're not that interested in things like sustainability, carbon emissions, all that stuff. The fact that I can sell them a tastier piece of meat than they're going to buy anywhere else is, in my mind, a net win for the world or for the whole notion of sustainability, because those people are going to eat as much meat as they're going to eat. They should eat meat that is raised well. They should eat meat that is produced by workers who are part of a union. They should eat meat that is produced from animals that aren't crammed into big confined animal feeding operations. You know, Lisa Simpson said it, you don't make friends with salad. So this, you know, like the big, you know, battle cry that nobody should eat meat. We should all eat a vegetable-based diet because that's the answer for the planet. It may very well be that a vegetable diet is going to be better from a net carbon emissions point of view, but it's not going to happen right now. You know, the people who are going to keep eating meat and want to eat meat are going to buy meat.
The listeners should know that he was looking at me the whole time while he was giving
this
speech.
Is getting me hungry. So what is your favorite, like, most bizarre kosher regulation that we've never heard of?
Oh man, I'm like so in the wormhole. What's it? Nothing is bizarre to me anymore. This stuff is. Oh man,
what surprised you when you first took up the knife?
Oh, you know, I think one of the things that can be most shocking and probably will be shocking to those
Shocking.
Of us.
Shocking.
To certainly to, you know, those in this room and probably, you know, most of the folks who are listening to this podcast is the world in which who is doing the slaughter and which organization is doing the slaughter is so important to people. Things like Hasidische Shechita, which really just means Hasidic slaughtermen.
But in now, a world in which Hasidische Shechita is, yeah, sorry.
Well, it's not just Hasidische Shechita. Does the shochet go to the mikveh, the ritual bath every morning? Does the shochet's wife just cover her hair? Or does she shave her head?
Oh, it's so important if the shochet's wife has shown some locks of hair.
Or she's just wearing a hairnet.
And we all laugh.
It makes the meat taste so much better if she does.
And yet, there are communities who are, you know, and certifying agencies who these are the requirements for. Like, is that what I need? No. But that is what people demand.
The meat is tastier and chastier.
chastier, certainly.
So, final question. Quickly, on one foot, do you remember how you and I are related?
You are a cousin of my wife's grandmother, Judy.
Yeah, that's
look at you.
You get a C+ on that.
All right, that's passing.
So can you name the relation of me to your wife, Anna?
No.
Okay. We are second cousins once removed.
Well, you get a B+
so this
at
is a
least.
Real nepotism
I want names.
Oh, I can do it.
Let's do it.
Sure. Her great-grandmother, Rebecca, was the sister of my grandfather, Walter. Her grandmother, Judy, is the first cousin of my mother, Joanne. I am the second cousin of her mother, Dee Dee. She's my second cousin once removed. Our kids are third cousins.
Boom.
How do we find Grow and Behold Foods?
Very easily, growandbehold.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We deliver nationwide. We'll get the meat right to your home as soon as we possibly can.
I will eat your meat very soon.
Okay, and will you come back and give a report on whether on how
sure.
We want an honest report
I'll
on how good their meat is. All right.
Great.
I'll eat it today. I ate a lot of meat.
Naf Hanau, you've been a fabulous Jew of the week.
Thank you.
You have a child due any second. Your wife's
last week. So.
By the time this airs, you'll be a father of three. So thank you so much for coming on.
We are excited to announce Tablet's first ever essay competition, First Personal. Our editors are looking for previously unpublished work by writers living in North America who have never written for Tablet before. They are seeking submissions on the theme of belonging. Where do you feel at home or no longer at home, physically, spiritually, or culturally? How do you find community or a sense that you're a part of something larger than yourself? Are there places where you feel a sense of belonging or alienation or both? Tablet is seeking personal essays about your life and your experiences and how your thoughts and feelings have evolved over time. Tablet editors will review all submissions and choose their favorite 5, which they will edit with the writers. The authors of those 5 pieces will be brought to New York City to read their story in front of a live audience. A guest judge will then select the winner. The winning essay will be published in Tablet and the winner will receive $500. For more information and to submit your essay, please visit tabletmag.com/essay contest.
Our Gentile of the Week is Glynn Washington, the host of WNYC's Snap Judgment. Before creating Snap, Glynn worked as an educator, a diplomat, a community activist, a mountain hauler, a foot stomper. He's composed music. He's done spoken word. I caught up with him by Skype last month.
Right. So you're the Gentile of the Week. You ever been a Gentile of the Week before?
Kind of, yeah. But yeah, that's cool.
So I just wanted to have you on because, you know, what we do on our podcast involves some storytelling, and you've become like one of the new princes of storytelling. So do you ever worry in what you do that there's going to be storytelling fatigue that sets in, that there are going to be too many podcasts, too many books, too many whatever about it?
I do worry about the overuse of the term storytelling. It seems like everything now is storytelling. Everybody, you're designing a roller coaster and you're a storyteller or whatever. But as far as the actual process of telling stories, there's it's hard. And so I think that anything that's hard, there's just going to be people who are going to excel at it in a certain way. And, You know, so I just think that the process itself, you know, the grind of trying to make this stuff work, it weeds out a lot of people.
Yeah. So what makes them good? Like, how do you know when you have a winner?
I know that I have a winner when I feel something in both my head and in my heart. You know, there's an emotional component to it. We want to make stories at Snap that are as smart as anything you'll hear anywhere, but we're also looking for that heart language to sing as well. And that's what's hard. That's, you know, making sure that if there's an innovation with Snap, it's an innovation of perspective. We're trying to let the listeners wear someone else's skin. And that's a difficult trick, as it turns out. And when I feel something, when I feel the anger, when I feel the pain, the joy, the whatever that person feels in that moment, I know that I'm on to something.
Okay, so give me an example. Like, what's a moment where you had one of those moments where you thought, okay, now I'm feeling it go beyond the head into the heart?
I felt it recently. We're in the middle of a live show right now. This is what happens oftentimes, especially on a live setting. It's a little bit different. We're working with the storyteller to construct a story that over something that really happened, something that's true. And I'm like anyone else. I'm like every other storyteller, every other person, I think, and that there's stuff about myself that I recoil from, or stuff about my experience or my background or whatever I recoil from. And more often than not, real stories are found right there, right? Wherever you're picking at scabs, that's where the real story is. Recently, one of the finest storytellers in the world, I say that, his name is Don Reed, and he had a story and it wasn't quite working. And again, one of the best storytellers in the nation, and he didn't want to go there. And my job was to basically say, you know, he was telling a story about his sister who was transsexual. And it felt to me like he was glossing over something big. I kept asking him again and again, what happened here? What happened there? What happened there? What happened when you had that final meeting with her? And he kept dodging and weaving. And finally, he just said, I didn't tell her what I should have. I wasn't strong enough. She protected me all that time, and I couldn't protect her. And he wept. He wept. And it was a moment where the story, this is what he was trying to dance around. The story that he was trying to tell was there, but he couldn't even admit it to himself. And once he did, the story became so powerful and so magical. And he really took us with him. And it was a real gift that he allowed himself to go, that he gave everybody. And I really appreciated it.
So even the really good storytellers, sometimes they chicken out unless you push them.
Yeah. And look, I'm a good storyteller. I chicken out all the time. I chicken out all the time. I don't want to, you know, I don't, because I want to have a. Because
you want everyone to like you. Isn't it?
I want them to like me. I want them to like me. I want myself to think I'm a better person than I am. I don't want to see that sometimes, that those aspects of myself that aren't heroic or whatever. It's humbling. No one wants to be humble, and no one, or to be humbled, and especially have that happen in front of a million people. But that's where the stories are.
So I always joke when I'm teaching essay writing to young people. I say nobody wants to read your college application essay about your parents' divorce, the death of a pet, or your trip to Europe. I say they're just like they're too far gone. They're just cliches. Are there those cliches in the live or oral storytelling world, those two or three topics that are just so played out that it would take a lot to make somebody want to hear another story about them?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many of them at this point. And I blame them all. No. A lot of them, you know, my coming out story.
Right.
Or the first time someone called me an N-word or whatever. And now I learned a very valuable lesson from the old man in Asia.
So, I mean, some of the cliches, right? The cliches, a lot of times they will come from marginalized people kind of breaking through. So the coming out story or the first time you're called the N-word. But I mean, I sometimes wonder, like, what do I as the straight white middle class guy have to bring to the table in that I in particular have faced so little adversity. Does adversity make for good stories? There's another way of saying, are black people better storytellers?
You know, what's interesting, we can say the same thing about Jewish people. And yes,
yeah.
Adversity does make for great, great stories. And that, you know, the storytelling traditions that come from both of our communities. And one of the things, there's a guy, a good Hebrew soul, Josh Healy. He told a story mm-hmm. recently on Snap. And if you look at the fact pattern for that story, the fact pattern is, I went to the water park with my nephew.
I remember that story. Yep.
And the power of it, of his storytelling, just made it a masterpiece. And I guess I'm saying adversity and everything like that, that it certainly has its place. But some of these storytellers can make a movie happen out of a story about crossing the street.
Do you have a favorite right now?
A favorite story?
Story, yeah.
No.
That you've done on your show.
You know what? My favorite story is always a story I'm working on. And I'm working on a story right now. I was in the BART, which is the subway here. I was on the train. I'm about to go up an escalator, actually. And I see this woman and she says, "Hey, I know you." And I look at her and I started sobbing in the middle of the BART station. This woman, she was the NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit nurse when my boy was born. And seeing her just brought that point back when we had this healthy, what I thought was a healthy baby boy. I took him to get him warmed up in the incubator, and ER broke out. And we thought we were going to lose him. And I mean, I can't even talk. That's a story I can't tell. I can't even tell that yet. I'm not ready to tell that story. It was maybe the happiest I've ever been is pulling that stroller away from that hospital. Like, my boy, he's fine. My boy is fine. I'm one of the lucky ones that got to walk out of there and have a good, happy ending. But I wonder, you know, I'm wondering as I'm putting this together, if how that type of reaction that there's snot running down my nose, I'm teary eyed, I'm blubbering like a baby because of just seeing her put me back in that spot. And the episode that we're making is called Gratitude. And the gratitude that I have for her, for all of those nurses that stayed with me late night, for all of that love that they gave to strangers, I'm having a hard time putting it into words, and I'm a wordsmith. And that's the story I'm working on right now, and it's my favorite story right now, of course.
That was me talking with Glenn Washington, the host of WNYC's Snap Judgment. I once wrote a piece about him for The Atlantic magazine that they headlined NPR's Great Black Hope, which everyone at NPR was really, really mad about. But Glenn really dug it. A few Mazel Tovs of the week. Stephanie?
I got one. My Mazel Tov is to Seth Cohen from The OC. He's been getting me through this, you know, post-election haze. I've been watching him on like the fourth or fifth episode of season two. Seth Cohen, basically, are watching it together, and it's been really beautiful for us.
I love that you're now getting to The OC, which is from 2003.
No, I mean rewatching it.
2004.
I haven't watched it since high school, and Ben has watched it like five times.
It's
and
amazing.
I'm discovering that all of Ben's like moves are actually originated
Adam Brody
in The OC.
He learned from Adam Brody.
Yeah, the way a little bit of Ryan Atwood too.
The way I learned from Dylan Walsh.
Yeah,
the way I was, uh-huh. Yeah,
from Dylan Walsh, and not from David Silver,
not
at all.
Why'd you have to Jew me? Why couldn't I learn from Dylan Walsh?
Yeah, you know.
No, it was Brendan Walsh. Why couldn't I learn from Dylan McKay?
You definitely didn't learn from Dylan McKay. You learned from Brendan Walsh.
I learned everything.
I learned from Brenda Walsh.
You did learn from Brenda Walsh. You learned from Kelly. Liel?
I learned from Steve. My Mazel Tov.
We have to get on the show because Ian Ziering is a great Twitter Jew.
He is. He's great. Sounds like just a great guy who I'd get along with very well. My Mazel Tov this week goes to the former governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin. Here's a sentence you don't hear often, for standing up and noting that, you know, when a politician just tries to bully a company to ignore the demands of the free market and do something according to some central government planning, as Donald Trump did with Carrier, that is not conservative principle. And so we now live in an age in which the torchbearer of conservative purity and intellectual honesty is Sarah Palin.
Yay,
ooh, Lord.
America.
Yay, America.
Hashtag 2016.
Mazel tov to you, America.
Mazel tov, America. My mazel tov this week, I'm going to turn over to our listener, Sarah Link Ferguson, who asked if she could have the mazel tov. And she's an awesome listener, a loyal devotee. And I said, sure. She wrote to send props to her rabbi, Doug Alpert of Kol Ami in Kansas City, Missouri. She said, Rabbi Doug dedicates his life to social justice and inspires so many in our community far beyond the walls of our synagogue with his action. He was recently arrested along with hundreds of protesters seeking to raise the minimum wage to $15. Doug spent around 6 hours in jail and said it likely won't be the last time he's arrested for civil disobedience. Given our current political climate, the uptick in racial and ethnic violence, etc., I think we can all learn from Rabbi Doug's example and be the change we want to see in the world. I agree. Rabbi Doug, you get the mazel tov.
And if you need a lawyer, I think Sandy Cohen's available.
Unorthodox is brought to you by Tablet Magazine on the web at tabletmag.com. Our show is edited by Noah Levinson and produced by Alyssa Goldstein and Shira Talushkin. Kosher Slaughtering this week is by our guest, Naftali Hanau. On Twitter, we're at Tablet Mag. Our music is by Golem. We normally record in Argo Studios, but this week we're in CDM, which serves only ethically slaughtered podcasts. Shalom, friends. Well, hustles, grab your guns, your shadow weighs a ton. Driving down the road.